Well, it has been said that no man is an island. And there are many elements of truth to that, because we are ultimately all connected with others around us. We grow up in families, have relationships of some sort or another, even in the most distorted context sometimes. We all live in some sort of community, whether in the city or in the country, whether suburbia or some rural area, yet there are people that we connect with because of basic economic functionality or social involvement of some sort. It's just part of life that we have to deal with. And those who live near us are referred to as neighbors. And it may be someone as close as next door or across the street. And that's where, you know, where we get the idea of a neighborhood. We live in a neighborhood. The realtors, when they are listing something, they will note it's in this particular neighborhood, and that has some significance that is there. And then Jesus took the idea of neighbor and expanded it significantly to basically anyone that we encounter and anyone that you have the opportunity to show mercy and grace to. So that's very much an expanded idea. But our experience with neighbors can be rather mixed. If you think about your own experience over the years, those that you've had contact with, and I think many times various places we've lived over time, we've had, for the most part, rather positive experiences with neighbors, and it's been encouraging. But there are always a few that maybe not quite so encourage me. I remember when Susan and I were first married and we lived in a mobile home on Green Lake outside of Grand Rapids a bit, and a little mobile home park, and there was a neighbor who was right next door to us for part of the time that we were there. And I don't remember his name, but I remember the music that he played, because he played the same song over and over and over and over and over rather loudly. He had two big speakers that we could see. One had a picture of Jesus on it. The other had a picture of the devil on it. And I don't remember the song. I was thinking maybe it was Dreamweaver or something like that, but I don't remember now. It was probably something I tried to block from my thinking. But we've had those experiences with those around us. But now think about the young nation, Israel. That is the more recent one that has been revived. Think about the neighbor problems that they have had since 1948. They have been the object of concerted efforts to wipe them off the map by basically all of its neighbors all around. When you think over the years of the different experiences that Israel, even much earlier than more modern times, the experiences that they had with pesky neighbors. And when we were looking at chapter 7 earlier in the book of Isaiah, we saw that there was a northern coalition of two nations in particular, of Syria and the northern kingdom. And you'll recall these verses in chapter 7, verses 1 and 2, because this is important for the context of chapter 17 that we're coming to. It says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah." So it was in the days of Ahaz, king of Judah, "that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel," so we had Syria and Israel coming against Judah, "they went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it," because God was working things according to his plan, but there was this threat. "And it was told to the house of David," that is the people of Judah, "saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim." Now, Ephraim is the one of the larger tribes and was associated with the northern kingdom as a whole. "So his heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved with the wind." That is, they were shaking in their boots. this is the background for chapter 17. And there was this aggressive threat from their close neighbors that was giving them some serious concern. But we also know that this concern and this threat didn't escape the notice of Judah's God. So Isaiah is communicating God's planned judgment on these nations, and it's going to have some near and some far implications, some things that are going to be taking place sooner and some more later. And the future emphasis is quite clear, because when you look at the passage, the use of will and shall are very evident throughout this section. But it's again a reminder of the Abrahamic covenant, of a couple of elements that are there, and you will recall this, Genesis 12, 2 and 3, I will make you a great nation. This is talking, God speaking with Abraham. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, if you think about it, well, that's kind of odd, because part of the nation is going against the other part. That is, the northern kingdom, along with Syria, is going against the southern kingdom. But by this time, the northern kingdom had deviated so far. They were kind of going their own way, and they were heading for trouble. And so what we see here is an element of the narrowing of the covenant as it relates to the Davidic covenant and the Davidic line. God came to David in 2 Samuel 7 and noted that his lineage coming through Judah is going to be the line through which the Messiah was going to come, and through him that lineage would have someone on the throne eternally. And so there was a narrowing to Judah here. But there are two lessons that we can think about as we look at this text that would be helpful for us to remember. One is, it does matter how you treat God's people, how you treat, and specifically here, Judah, and that's the emphasis of the Old Testament. And it does matter how you treat your neighbors. That's the New Testament emphasis that Jesus brought. But there's more to the text that we want to consider here as well. But this background is helpful for us to think through some of the operation that's at work here. There is accountability for mistreatment of God's people. That's not explicit in the text, but it is implied based on the putting together of the reference in chapter 7 and following, and then putting it together with what's going on in chapter 17. So here we read, the burden against Damascus, that's the capital of Syria, behold, Damascus will cease from being a city, and it will be a ruinous heap. The cities of Aroer are shaken, are forsaken. They will be for flocks which lie down, and no one will make them afraid. The fortress also will cease from Ephraim. The fortress there is reference to Samaria. The kingdom from Damascus, the remnant of Syria, they will be as the glory of the children of Israel, says the Lord of hosts. And that's basically saying it's fading fast. And so what we see here is there's a coalition against God's people that is against God himself. So this coalition from the north that's rising up against Judah in the south is headed for trouble because of who they're ultimately going against. And so God's not going to stand for that. So this coalition is doomed to failure. They can count on it because they are doing what they're doing without God's blessing. They are not trusting in the Lord. They're trusting in themselves. The northern kingdom is aligning with the nation Syria, and that's not going to end well. And again, trusting in men, not in God. And so God is announcing that these nations are going to have trouble, and they're going to lose their sovereignty. They're going to lose their glory. And we know historically that Assyria destroyed Damascus in 732 B.C., and Samaria was destroyed in 722 B.C. And so this was a near fulfillment. It was not an idle threat. It was something that, in short order, was going to be historical reality. and they were not paying attention to the messages that were being communicated to them, because the Northern Kingdom had prophets come as well as the Southern Kingdom did. Other coalitions today can expect the same fate if you are not following the Lord and trusting in Him, if you're trusting in other coalitions, you can expect trouble. Just think about how well the Axis powers did in World War II. Well, they had their day, but they ultimately came to an end. And if you think about some of the alliances, the political schemes that people are putting together against Israel today, the PLO, the Muslim Brotherhood, I mean, you name it, they're out there. Are they going to be ultimately successful? No, you can count on that as well. Then continuing on, verses 4 through 6 of chapter 17, "In that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob will wane, and the fatness of his flesh grow lean. It shall be as when the harvester gathers the grain and reaps the heads with his arm. It shall be as he who gathers heads of grain in the valley of Rephaim. Yet gleaning grapes will be left in it, like the shaking of an olive tree, two or three olives at the top of the uppermost bough, four or five in its most fruitful branches, says the Lord God of Israel." And what that's essentially saying is the people who are going against Judah are going to be harvested, but there will be some remnant, some remains. So that's what's essentially communicated. Judgment against these people will include some grace. That is, there will be some who survive. But there will be decline and deterioration in the future. Turns out the immediate was not that long before this was going to be taking place. The cities would be depopulated, would become essentially grazing lands instead of population centers. We know that that happened to both Syria and Israel, where Assyria came in, the further northern kingdom came in and decimated both of them and took them captive, and so that was just what had been predicted, and is what they had coming because of their unbelief. That was the basic emphasis that's communicated there. Now, she would experience this thorough reaping of her population as reapers harvest the grain, and they get most of it, but there's usually something that's left. And it's referencing here the Valley of Rephaim, which was a productive place, but it had the idea of shades or ghosts, or has the idea of ultimately ending in death and despair. And so the judgment was not arbitrary. It was a consequence of unbelief and disobedience that this was coming on them. And so it was a warning not only to the northern kingdom but also to Judah. If you don't trust the Lord, look what happens. Well, it's a judgment that we ought to learn something from as well, because, again, if we don't trust the Lord, what is going to happen? There are always consequences that we have to deal with. There will be a few people who survive in both nations. That's the emphasis that's noted in the last couple of verses there, of a few olives or fruits that are left for the gleaners to collect. And we saw that picture illustrated in the book of Ruth, who was a gleaner as well. But one commentator noted with regard to the lesson that Judah should be picking up here: Judah need not fear her neighbors. That is, those who are coming from the north, they really needed to deal with their God and trust in Him. And that's the lesson that they were needing to pick up on a lesson for all of us, again, to pick up on. Are we rightly related to Him in all things and trusting in Him in the daily routine of life? Then there is accountability for neglecting the Creator. Verses 7 through 9 say, in that day a man will look to his Maker, and his eyes will have respect for the Holy One of Israel. So in that day, there will be a time when, after the judgment has come, when they will start to say, oh, I guess I better pay attention to my Maker, to my Creator. He will not look to the altars, the works of his hands. He will not respect what his fingers have made, nor the wooden images, nor the incense altars. Instead of our inclination to trust all the things around us that we have put together. In that day, his strong cities will be as a forsaken bough and an uppermost branch, which they left because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation. So this is trying to put things in perspective. The time will come when everyone must face his Creator. And judgment has a way of getting our attention. And that's what this message is essentially trying to do for Judah, of letting them know that as they're thinking about this threat from the north, that's not their biggest problem. It's they're dealing with their trust in the Lord. And our year verse, of course, brings that out as well. So the coming destruction that would result for the Israelites and the Syrians would ultimately cause them to have to think about their relation to their Creator, and also would be causing Judah to do so as well. So the purpose of the judgment has to do with both justice and refocus. That is, there's a reckoning for sin, that's the judgment, but also a realization of one's relation to God. Am I rightly related to Him or not? And that's what we need to think about today. You think about, well, have there been judgments that have been going on in our world today? I mean, sometimes we see things happening like hurricanes, tornadoes, wildfires, and all the rest. And we wonder, are those judgments? Could they be? They could be. They have been in the past. Does it get our attention? Sometimes, for a little while. Have you ever wondered why so many things happen in California? I just throw that out. It's just a question. But you don't have to think about it too hard. And you have to be careful not to take that too far, because Scripture also tells us that there isn't a one-to-one correspondence between something bad happening to somebody and their sin. But sometimes there is. But another thought here, distractions with God's substitutes is still a common problem. And the emphasis here was, rather than looking to your idols, your objects of devotion that aren't God, you need to be looking to Him. That's the picture. And blatant idolatry was certainly common in the day. And it was something that it seemed after the captivities that the nation as a whole finally caught on to and said, well, we're not going to do that again because look what happens. And so we should have learned from that. But the lure of idolatry continues and has taken many different forms. I wonder if any of us have thought about what are our objects of idolatry today. Some of us carry them close to us. Could that be an object of idolatry? How much time do we spend with our electronic devices? How much of our attention do they take? Is our technology, the work of our hands, comparable to the imagery that's there? think about how much we depend on our phones, our smartphones in particular. Who are we supposed to be depending on? Do we depend on those? Think of how much information we have available for us. I mean, who needs God when you have Google and GPS? You can get anywhere and you can find out anything you want to know. So is God really needed? Well, what if the power goes out? God has a way of kind of smiling down at us and say, oh, lost power, did you? Huh. Now who are you going to depend on? I was reminded of that when I was camping last week in certain places where there was no cell service. And then you realize, oh yeah, this is what quiet is. This is not bad. And you get to think about other things and other people, the Lord in particular. So there is some value in stepping back and thinking about, oh, is there the potential of depending on our technology more than on God? Could that be a form of idolatry? It could be. Isaiah has a lot to say about idolatry, much more coming up. But it does cause us to ask ourselves from time to time, what or who am I trusting? Something to think about. Well, pressing on, verses 10 and 11, and then we'll consider what this has for us as well. Because you have forgotten the God of your salvation, because you've been distracted by other things, and have not been mindful of the rock of your stronghold, therefore you will plant pleasant plants and set out foreign seedlings. In the day you will make your plant to grow, and in the morning you will make your seed to flourish. In other words, you're doing your own thing, and you think this is all going to turn out well because you're doing your own thing. He said, but the harvest will be a heap of ruins in the day of grief and desperate sorrow. So beware, again, of what you're trusting in. The time will come when everyone must face his failures. As we well know, it's too easy to forget God amid the busyness of life. There are so many things that vie for our attention, and we can forget all that God has done for us, including the salvation that we have in him. And we can become anchored on other things for our refuge. It's too easy to think we can do it ourselves, that we can sow our own plans, but what will we reap? Will it come to pass? If we're trusting in those things, we'll reap disaster. Ultimate failure will come from our own efforts, like wood, hay, stubble that is talked about in 1 Corinthians 3. And that passage also talks about a day of reckoning for believers as well as unbelievers in terms of, for the believers, it's the judgment seat of Christ relating to what we have done. For unbelievers, it's more serious than that. But in any regard, there is a tension that we must have to where we're trusting, who we're trusting, what we're trusting. In him or in ourselves or our stuff, our intelligence, our technology, or whatever. So continuing on, verses 12 through 14, woe to the multitude of many people who make a noise like the roar of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations will rush like the rushing of many waters, but God will rebuke them, and they will flee far away and be chased like the chaff of the mountains before the wind, like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. Then behold, at eventide, trouble, and before the morning, he is no more. This is the portion of those who plunder us, the lot of those who rob us. So we note here, there is a time when some will face his rebuke. And the idea is a wave of destruction is coming upon these nations. Those who are trusting in themselves, making alliances instead of trusting in God. And the what's communicated here is that there are going to be many warriors who are going to descend on Israel, the northern kingdom, ultimately the southern kingdom as well. And they will be like the waves of the sea. But even those who come upon them will not last long. For instance, when Assyria overtakes Syria, and that is Damascus and that nation, and then the northern kingdom, how long will the nation that takes them down be in power before they're taken down? Not that long. So there's ultimate judgment coming in that regard as well. The generic reference to perpetrators here indicates multiplicity. That is, Isaiah doesn't get specific and name a particular nation here as the enemy, probably because he's anticipating that there's going to be more than one nation who is going to be rising up at different times, in some cases successively. And ultimately, if you look at the larger eschatological scheme of things, there will be more that will happen in the tribulation period that will be included as well. And we know, just looking at Israel's history, whether you're looking at the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom or any of the other times, how much trouble has Israel, God's people, encountered from its neighbors over the years. It's quite amazing. Well, then we come to chapter 18. And what follows in chapter 18 is an example of how the nations are subject to God. And this will have some eschatological implications as well as some more present implications with regard to one of the nations who would ultimately destroy Damascus and Ephraim in Isaiah's day. So here we note there is accountability for independent superpowers. And the superpower is something that we can relate to today because we see the tensions that we deal with, but they were dealing with those same kinds of things back at this time. And so we have some interesting language here, and we want to figure out who exactly we're talking about. Woe to the land shadowed with buzzing wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, but you might want to read there Cush. That's the Hebrew there. Ethiopia is an interpretation. Which sends ambassadors by sea, even in vessels of reed or papyrus, depending which version you're looking at, on the water, saying, go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth of skin, to a people terrible from their beginning onward, a nation powerful and treading down, whose land the rivers divide. All inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, when he lifts up a banner on the mountains, you see it. When he blows a trumpet, you hear it. So there's going to be something else coming down the line here that they need to be aware of. So what we want to observe is a people of prominence will collaborate God's pronouncement of judgment.